Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend as we talk today about the arts in Central Ohio. It is a cold and gloomy day outside, but I suspect we're going to have a ribald, at the very least, conversation for the next hour. My guests are Joy Riley, a professor of theater at The Ohio State University and the theater critic for WOSU. Welcome, Joy Riley.
Thank you.
Steve Geyer is the executive director and CEO of Shadowbox Live, with two facilities going on right now. And Chuck Helm is Director of Performing Arts at the Wexner Center. We're going to get the conversation going and then invite your phone calls to 292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Joy Riley, our theater critic, came into the studio brandishing a program from Mary Poppins, which you saw last night. I'm old enough to have seen the first run of the movie. So will I like the show?
You will like this production. This production is enchanting. I actually had never seen it before. I hadn't seen them. I saw little bits of the movie and didn't particularly sort of cotton on to it. It wasn't sort of my sort of thing. But this production that actually had its opening last night is absolutely fabulous. It's got certain things that are very, very... The thing that isn't strong about it is the story or the plot, which is sort of...
Oh, come on,
it goes
Joy.
On. It has everything in it, including the kitchen sink. But it hasn't... It's not about that. That's not what it's about. It's about magic. It's about enchantment. It's about dreaming. It's about... being a lovely family. It's about learning how to deal with your problems, and it's about magic. And this particular production, I had Marty Savolsky's with me. He is he's a critic with me here in Columbus. He's actually a designer. He's a design student at OSU, but he's also worked backstage in New York. He knows at least 10 of the cast of this particular production that he studied with them. And he, being a designer, we sat there and he said that he had never seen such a smooth production of Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins is sort of, it's a mix of Cameron Mackintosh wondrous producing and Walt Disney movie and lots of other things. But I will say, if you have kids, take them to see this production. This is the kind of life-changing event for a child that they will remember all their lives.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I can still say it. It's been 45
well
years.
Well done.
I can still say it now. Pretty good. Now, so if you know the songs from the movie, that's what you're going to hear in the theater?
Yes. Okay. And, but you're going to hear some new ones.
Great.
They're always adding to it. And so this production... originally started based on the storybook, the Tales
of P.L. Travers
book. Yes. And then Cameron Mackintosh in the early 90s was negotiating to get that from her. But it didn't arrive as he wanted to make it into a play. But then eventually they decided to try and make it into a musical when Disney came on board. But I think it was in 2004 that they had the first production in the West End in London. And then eventually it came over to America, and it was successful on Broadway, and then it started touring around.
It's still on Broadway, I think. Or if it closed, it was just recent. It had a good run.
Yeah,
it had a long run.
It did have a very good run. I'm not sure whether it's there or not. But it's now been touring for about 2 years. This is a very young cast. It's got a Mary Poppins who's in the ensemble. She's absolutely fantastic. She has a gorgeous voice, and she's not too saccharine. She's just a lovely portrayal, and two adorable kids, and bad people and good people and marvelous effects.
How was the audience? Did they clue into it right away?
This audience was absolutely enchanted by this production. I sat there smiling. I couldn't believe myself. I was smiling and I'm thinking, yes, this is so happy. But I was looking at the brilliance behind the design and how they did the scene changes in 10 seconds. The most complex set I've seen in years.
This is running at the Ohio Theater, is
at
that
the
correct?
Ohio Theater.
Opened last night. I think it's here for 3 weeks, right?
That's right. It continues, I think, through the 8th of May. And as I say, I don't normally go around saying, I don't really like going to shows with hundreds of kids. And I was astonished when my husband said he wanted to go with me. But I never heard the kids. The kids were absolutely marvelous. They were just so mesmerized.
They were just included,
It was the energy coming from the stage into the audience.
Mary Poppins opened last night. It's at the Ohio Theater for 3 weeks, and if Joy Riley says it's good, go. Steve Geyer, you're a very busy guy. You're the CEO and you're the founder, are you not, of Shadowbox, the Shadowbox Cabaret. Give me a thumbnail of what Shadowbox is.
Shadowbox got started a long time ago with producing my rock operas, and Joy can remember that. She interviewed me 22 years ago on that subject. They weren't very good, so we switched gears and started doing fairly traditional theater, and then found that that was a relatively crowded environment in Columbus, and we started playing around with sketch comedy and rock and roll because we had a personal interest, and we had kind of watched Saturday Night Live fade in their intensity at that point and found that there was an opportunity. So we began to fill that opportunity, and as the years have gone by, we have also once again reached back into the rock operas and the musicals and things like that, and that's become a very important and successful part of the operation. So we are really busy. We have all of that going on, and we're doing it in two cities.
Why are you in Newport, Kentucky? Not that it's not a lovely place. and here.
Well, to be honest, the idea of going to Newport had mostly to do with Jaromir Steiner, the gentleman who helped to bring us to the Easton Town Center in the first place. He was creating Newport on the Levee, which is associated with the aquarium down there, and he really wanted us to be a part of the process. We said no two times. And finally, the third time, he convinced us that if we ever wanted to really grow the brand in a significant way, we had to at least try it, and that he was willing to help us try it. So I finally, foolishly, said yes. And to be completely fair, for us, it has been a great experience. There's been so much growth that goes along with giving people the kind of opportunity and freedom that they have by being in their own operation, that's been wonderful. On the other side of the coin, the Levee itself has not been the most successful environment in the world. They kind of got the tenant mix wrong when they got that place started, and they've really struggled to keep it full.
Did they make like a mini mall of things around? You know, I know the aquarium quite well, and when I was down there last, the Levee was just getting started, so I haven't seen it in full operation.
That's a perfect description. It's a mini mall. It is Easton light, very light, you will. And they kind of, for some reason, put together really adult entertainment and food and beverage along with kids retail. Just kind of the worst combination imaginable, which, of course, didn't work. And so they've spent 10 years now trying to find something that would. We've been lucky in that because we are our own destination, we've had a fair degree of success. It hasn't really mattered to us too much that hasn't been a part of the mix.
But there's good news coming. You're coming back to Columbus full-time, and I want to get to that in a moment, but I want to say hello to Chuck Helm, who is the head of performing arts at the Wexner Center. You're the guy responsible for a lot of great and compelling theater and music that we've seen for the past several years. A couple of highlights for me have been the Abbey Theater's recent visit from Ireland. Anne Bogart is a regular visit here, the great theater director. What in the last year or so has really exceeded, if you will, your expectations?
Well, the Abbey Theater's production of Terminus by the playwright Marco Ro that we just did a month ago was fantastic. I mean, Marco Ro is a younger playwright, and the Abbey has a real tradition of developing young artists. But Mark is known sort of for his invented language. Some of his plays, he had an early play called Disco Pigs, which was sort of a youth culture show that was all in invented language, not unlike like in Clockwork Orange, sort of that the invented slang of that. So you could totally follow the narrative line, but none of these were actual words that people speak on the streets.
This was not your grandmother's Juno and the Paycock.
Right.
No,
so,
okay.
So we didn't bring that production. I happened to see it in Canada a few years ago. But anyway, I had my eye on Mark, and when he hooked up with the Abbey to do Terminus, and Terminus is all done in rhyme, and just the kind of incredible sense of language that the Irish acting tradition brings, and their ability to invest your emotions and the kind of flow of the language, and to have it in rhyme, it lent this very starkly staged. It's a three-actor show, and it's just a very minimal black stage with these broken shards of mirrors behind them. Anyway, it had this whole phantasmagorical aspect of it, and I think the language really drew you into this. And it also was sort of a wild, raw tale that they told. But it was very engrossing, and people just – I mean, I had a lot of people tell me that that was one of the most fantastic shows that they'd seen in a while. And actually, in the month before that, we also had one of our big highlights of this year, which was to bring Anna Deavere Smith here to the Lincoln Theater for her run of her performance, Let Me Down Easy. And it was kind of a gamble on our part because we did seven performances. That's a little over 500 seats. It's a lot of people in this community for relatively – I mean, even though we had the cheapest tickets anywhere on her national tour, I think for Columbus, a ticket that was a little under $50 was a bit of a stretch for some people. But we did a lot of outreach efforts. I mean, the show Let Me Down Easy, where she portrays 21 characters that she interviews like hundreds of people and then distills it down to the character she wants. But it follows a theme about the body and healthcare, looking at people that are either caregivers or people that have been affected by injuries or, you know, like a rodeo rider or people that have been affected by life-threatening illnesses such as Lance Armstrong, the cycling champion and cancer survivor. She had, you know, all these kinds of people she portrayed, but it really built a lot of word of mouth. We did a great partnership with the OSU Medical Center, who were terrific to work with. And we had incredibly good houses. I think we were about 80% overall, which is, you know, usually your typical goal. And so we did fine on it in terms of audiences, in terms of economy, and certainly in terms of the impact of the show.
When I sat there with her at her show, I closed my eyes on purpose, and you would never know it was one person because she was so compelling. And that's a trademark of her work. She always does one-person shows where she plays an entire community, and she's done that for a number of years. I would have thought she would have been a real easy sell here because of her profile on TV. People know her, and they recognize her.
Well, yeah, we certainly, like I think everybody else that's involved in this tour, let people know about Nurse Jackie, but which is on Showtime, so people have to know about that. Or The West Wing is the one
most people
know
yeah.
about. It definitely helps. It just takes a while to sort of people to make that connection. I mean, even years ago, I brought in the first residency with his own company was Savion Glover to premiere his own company. And we thought, oh, Savion Glover, he'd been on Noise Funk on Broadway. Nobody knew what that was. And then you'd say, he's the guy that's on Sesame Street. Or at that time, he was doing a promo for Monday Night Football. It was Savion Glover Hank Williams Jr. It's like he's the tap dance guy that's not Hank Williams Jr. on Monday Night Football. Oh, that guy. So then people came to that too. But you know, I mean, you really have to kind of work that because people don't necessarily recognize the name, at least that number of people.
How did you like the Lincoln Theater working down there, bringing a Wexner co-production to the Lincoln?
Well, it was our second time we'd gone there. We had a great show there last season when we brought in this historical soul review. We did the show with this. It was a soul music review, but it also featured a lot of the soul music bands that had started in Columbus back in the 60s and the 70s that this particular record label in Chicago had been bringing back to light. Anyway, so we knew about the theater, and I thought that the scale of the theater, the intimacy of the theater was fantastic.
Beautiful.
And, of course, you know, to bring a prominent African-American artist like Anna to this whole idea of the Lincoln and the revitalization of the East Side neighborhood, that was a great opportunity. Technically, though, it was a challenge. The theater is really not, in terms of its technical infrastructure, ready for that scale of production. And we got a little bit – I mean, we all made it work thanks to our great tech team. But initially, it was going to be a very stripped-down version. And at the end, Anna said, no, I'm only comfortable with the version that was on stage. So we had to hang a lot of extra truss work out over the audience and to find places to hang it because, you know, it's a beautifully restored theater. You have to go up, like, literally through the light sockets to find a place where there's a beam to put the lights up.
But it looked great, though.
It looked great. It fit beautifully.
The theater looked beautiful, and the show looked beautiful, and we have to take a break. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend with Steve Geyer, Chuck Helm, and Joy Riley. We'll be back in a few seconds. I forgot how many.
So according to Standard & Poor's, it won't be long before the USA is an unsafe place to invest your money. The president denied this, of course, and asked all Americans to do their part to help by sending him money to get a Nigerian dictator's fortune out of that country. Dear kind sir or madam, I'm Peter Sagal, and I'm asking you to join us for the new junk-rated news quiz from NPR.
And Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is tomorrow morning at 11 here on 89.7 NPR News. 45 degrees in downtown Columbus with showers and thunderstorms possible throughout the day. Some of those storms could produce heavy rainfall and a high of 54 degrees. Expect showers and thunderstorms tonight, and the temperature will rise to 61 degrees. More rain for Saturday, mainly in the morning, and then cloudy skies and a high of 68 degrees. And unfortunately, the rain is sticking around for Sunday as well, a high of 68. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I hope the Easter Bunny has an umbrella. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend as we talk about the arts today with Steve Geyer, who is the executive director and CEO of Shadowbox. Chuck Helm is the director of performing arts for the Wexner Center. Joy Rivey is WOSU's theater critic and on the faculty of the Department of Theater at The Ohio State University. You were just asking, Joy, you were just asking Chuck off mic about something. So
yes,
give it to the public.
Yeah. Well, I was asking Chuck how his very unusual and innovative Susurrus in Franklin Park went in the conservatory.
What is that?
Oh, Susurrus is a play by a Scottish playwright named David Letty, but it's a bit unusual in that it's an audio play. So, and the audience hears it on headphones with an iPod. And it's staged always at Botanical Gardens. And it's kind of a bit of a riff on Midsummer Night's Dream, as well as a very kind of a contemporary story that he tells about this kind of bohemian family. It involves an opera singer who was performing Benjamin Britten's version of Midsummer Night's Dream and his family and their relationships and kind of a tragic unfolding of events. But anyway, what you do is you go to Franklin Park Conservatory and you get an iPod and headphones and you get a map that is a route through both the greenhouses and the gardens. And you follow this sort of routed map and you listen to a section of this audio play at about 12 different stops. And we did that. This was our season opener, I think last October we did it. So the weather was beautiful at the park. I mean, it was, you know, Indian summer kinds of days. And it's an incredibly moving story. And it was sort of – it's always interesting because people with this particular show, they could go on a beautiful, sunny, 70-degree afternoon and say, oh, the way it worked with the environment and the stops. And then they would come on a day like today where it would be rain and said, oh, it was so emotionally strong with the rain. I'm so glad I went.
Weatherproof.
I was afraid I was going to be uncomfortable, but I really got into it. So it was a fabulous experience. In fact, we had to extend. We were able to get another batch of iPods from one of my – tour partners on this one and extend the show, which was great. And the people at Franklin Park were terrific to work with. We hope to work with them again.
You're a really good salesman because I didn't know about that. And now I really am kicking myself that I didn't go because that sounds fantastic. That sounds
Marilyn Smith,
yes,
our producer here, went and I went together. Mm-hmm. And it was an extraordinary experience. I had no idea it was going to be such fun. And I had an emotional reaction to. Absolutely what you're saying, Chuck.
Well, the story, the narrative is a bit like a confessional, and the tone of the voice of the actors, there's really about four principal characters. But listening to it on headphones, it's so intimate, and it's so transporting how it affects you. So.
And you feel you have control, and you're a player in the piece. So it gives you sort of because you start off in that lovely conservatory, and then, of course, you've got these, you put on your earphones, and you go to different places. You have to find the place. It's like a treasure hunt. And then you find the place, and you turn on to the next thing on your iPod, and you listen to it, and there's music, and there's Peter Pierce singing or something.
Oh,
it's absolutely.
Piaf and all
yeah,
kinds of things.
I mean, it's beautiful music. Beautiful music.
Yeah, you listen to music. There's a selection of music that ties to the narrative that you listen as you walk from station to station.
Stop. Bring it back.
But then you go outside, and then you walk in for miles over bridges and through fields, and you feel that you're sort of part of the sort of outside environment.
It's a real connect, a good place to have it. No wonder they have to be in botanical gardens, and we're lucky to have the conservatory there. I want to encourage people to call in if you'd like to talk about the arts in Central Ohio or ask questions of our panel. This is the sort of edgy panel that really makes things happen that might be sometimes unusual but are always successful, and you always wonder where you've been if you haven't experienced them before. 292-8513, that's a 614 number. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org, or you can get in touch with us at Facebook, again, 292-8513. Steve Geyer, you're trying to move. On your website, it says, if you can swing a hammer, call me. What's that about?
Well, we started looking about 7 years ago for a new home and finally made the deal.
Now, you'd been in a warehouse downtown that burned down, is that right?
Yeah, actually, we were in two different warehouses downtown, but only one of them burned, the one on Spring Street. And then we moved out to Easton and sent a party of folks on a trip down to greater Cincinnati and did our two cozy experiments on High Street. All of those things have had their own measure of success, but none of them really felt complete. None of them felt like home. We really wanted to be back in the downtown area in a community, in a neighborhood. So when the Brewery District opportunity raised its head, we were as aggressive as we knew how to be, being a broke arts organization, and pursued that. And finally, around Thanksgiving, things finally came to fruition. So we have actually broken ground there. They're beginning to make all the changes that need to be made. It's truly thrilling to be in a historic building that's 130-year-old
building. Tell us about the building. Where is it? It's the Worley Building?
The Worley Building, yes, on Front Street.
Okay.
And it's an iconic building in the Brewery District. It's, as I say, 130 years old. It was originally built by Mr. Hoster of the brewing company to house his horses, wagons, hay, and straw. And
he must have had a lot of that because it's a big building.
It's enormous. I think what he had a lot of was ego. This was a statement, and quite a statement. And the building on the inside, I mean, it's just fantastic. It wears its age beautifully, and it's so fun to go from the very brand-new manufactured environment that we're in right now into this clearly handmade, hand-hewn wood environment with all the brick that's kind of crumbling, and it's just really gorgeous.
What had the building been used for up until now? Had it been abandoned? Was anything going on with it?
It went through many, many changes. During World War II, it was a USO station, and the Worley family bought the building and made it a plumbing and supply facility for a number of years. Billy Schottenstein transformed the building in the 90s into the kind of office upstairs and restaurant and home for CD101 downstairs that it had become. And now it's going through another set of changes, you know, with CD101 moving down to the Swiss Chalet to gain a lot of extra space, but they're still in the same neighborhood. And the rest of that building, for the most part, being converted to functions that have more to do with Shadowbox than anything else. I think we have about 60 or 65% of the building at this point.
That's a lot of space. What are you going to do with it? There is a bona fide theater in there, is that right, that's being restored?
No.
No, okay.
No, there's nothing remotely like a theater.
Okay.
So we are transforming it from what it was into that. And that is quite a transformation, removing all the posts and adding tremendous amount of overhead structure to get the clear space that we need. It's an incredible transformation. So what's happening for us is that we're now able to have a place to rehearse, which we haven't had for 12 years. We have a backstage, which we haven't had. We have dressing rooms, which people won't have to dress in the hallways anymore. It's amazing what it will offer us just in terms of a normal way to do business. In addition to that, we are opening our own bistro. You know, we've done food service and drink service with Shadowbox forever, but we recognize that we were losing a great deal of business before and after shows with people needing to go somewhere else. So we wanted to do something that allowed us to capture some of that. But even more importantly, it allows us to connect with the neighborhood and the community in a 20-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week sort of way.
Food always works.
My point. You know, Rebecca Gentile, who was the co-founder 22 years ago with me, was very clear in the early days to say, one of the things I don't particularly care for in most traditional theatrical environments is that I can't eat and drink while I'm watching a show. So it was her desire and inspiration that sent us in that direction.
There are ushers who will spank you. I mean, if you dare bring in anything. I think what you're talking about is the new way to go. I think you need to really establish a comfort zone for the audience and for the performers as well. And the sort of, not fourth wall, but the fifth wall has to come down, I think, really. And I think the two of you are really prime examples of always making that happen. I think the Wexner Center, by virtue of its building, makes it easier to do that. And you're taking an old building and making it new again.
Right.
Which is very exciting. And if people want to hear more about that, call us at 292-8513. We have a call from Carol in Dayton, who's been waiting patiently. She saw Mary Poppins last night. Hello, Carol.
Hello. I did. I went with my daughter and two grandchildren, and I'm of the certain age that grew up and knew Julie Andrews. And I have to say that the woman who played Mary Poppins did a fabulous job. Her own talent and style came through, but it drew in those of us, and I think there's lots of us, who have the Julie Andrews thing. And she just drew us in, and there was no line having to be drawn. No comparison ever had to be made. The show itself is very engaging. And if you have a wiggly grandchild with you, make them stay to the second half because it absolutely explodes.
Okay.
Yeah, and the only little pan I would have is as exciting and wonderful as most of the choreography was, I felt that the tap dancing was just a little weak. It was, but that could be just because I'm such a tap dance fan.
What did you think of the number going up onto the roof?
I thought that was magical. I don't know how he stayed straight. I don't know. You're talking when Bert walked around?
Yes, when he danced on the ceiling.
Oh, my gosh, it was wonderful. My feet were going. You know, the hardest part in much of it was to not sing along, you know.
I'm sure they wouldn't mind. I think that's a good sign from the audience.
Oh, I agree. The children were just all mesmerized, but so were the adults.
Did you like the children on stage?
I have grandchildren in England who are American but have now taken on British accents. I was amazed to find that the children were not British. The accents, particularly Jane, and there were some words that, you know, that I know that my grandchildren say differently than the British children, and she said them the British way.
Actually,
I was just amazed.
I absolutely agree with you, and I'm from over there, and I am always very, you know, I have to sort of keep myself in check normally when I hear mm-hmm. people do dialects. But I think there were a lot of Canadian performers in this production. I know there were some uh-huh. major ones, and their accents were just wonderful.
Carol, I have to move on, but I do thank you very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. 292-8513 is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. What I thought was great is when I came into the studio to begin the program, you three were already here, and you all know each other, the three of you. You were all schmoozing as if, you know, well, what were we talking about 25 years ago when we first met or whatever? So I want to ask particularly the two gentlemen, what's the temperature out there for collaboration between arts organizations in this area?
I think civically there's a lot of emphasis on it that more and more is because, number one, you've got some arts organizations in this area because of the economy and general trends that they're struggling. So people are looking to maximize efficiencies and also, you know, the creative spark that you get from talking to other organizations about ideas. You know, like I say, we had this incredible collaboration with Franklin Park Conservatory, and we raised money together. We actually made a few bucks off of this interesting but different kind of a production, certainly brand new thing for them. And I think that you learn so much about how other organizations work, and you get kind of benefits from that. So, you know, we've had collaborations over the years with, like, the Symphony, Ballet Met, Pro Music, quite a few organizations around town. And, I always find that, I mean, there's certain challenges in trying to make sure that everybody's on the same page that you have to get established. But, Steve, you've got something going on with Ballet Met.
Ballet
now,
Met,
right?
The Seven Deadly Sins. Talk about that.
Yeah. We actually premiered the Seven Deadly Sins a week from today. At the Capitol Theater at the Rife Center. Which
this isn't the Kurt Vile one, is it?
I don't think
this
it is.
This is a rock.
No.
Yeah, this is a talk about. Yeah.
This is mostly original music from us. Matt Hahn and I have written the majority of the score.
Great.
And we were able to work with six different choreographers from around the country. This is really mostly due to the courage of Gerard Charles, the artistic director over there, because I think it takes a certain degree of courage and a touch of insanity to call Shadowbox and say, hey, let's collaborate, particularly if for no other reason because it's not something we've done much of. I mean, I know so little about it. I think, you know, sitting here with Chuck and Joy, these folks, their history of collaboration, and I suppose particularly with Chuck at the Wexner Center, that's what they do. And it's been an incredibly impressive thing. And for us, watching from the outside, it's been inspirational. And it's one of the things that when the phone call finally came from Gerard, honestly, it led us to be willing to say, you know what, I know that you've had collaborations that have been successful with other organizations, and looking at what they did with the Wexner Center, we were able to say, okay, we'll try this. And what I didn't have sense enough to do was to call Chuck and say, okay, how should I do this?
I've seen some of the rehearsals. I've crashed them. It looks to me like you're doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm really excited with where it's gone. I truly am. It's been an interesting process because you walk into these things with certain sets of expectations, and then you learn what reality is as time goes by. And when you're dealing with so many different choreographers from all over the country, all over the world, you learn very quickly that getting on the same page is an interesting challenge. So that's been a big part of the process for us. And now we're at a place where we feel like we've finally got the music where it needs to be. And the dancers are happy with us. The choreographers seem to be happy with us. If next week we can make Gerard happy, then everybody wins. And I think the audience will certainly, at the very least, have a unique experience at the ballet.
This is a different kind of a ballet presentation, although it does feature the dancers from Ballet Met, quite a few of them, and your music. So you're providing the sound. Is that you're providing the music? Is that right? And probably the book or whatever the stage direction is.
Exactly.
Is that it? Tell me now, Shadowbox. Shadowbox maintain a standing company of actors and musicians? And is there a great deal of improvisation in the presentations, or is it all scripted?
We have a company of 60. Performers, and they most everybody does several different things, several different disciplines. It's sort of our approach to the arts. So we like to call them meta performers. They can do it all. And the essence of what we do is not to use improvisation on stage, but it's to use it aggressively in rehearsal. The idea is that we want to try out everything we can think of and find the very best nuggets and bring that to the stage. And we're careful when we hit the stage because our audience tends to think of us as a reliable source of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Our philosophy is we're asking you to get off the couch, get in your car, drive to wherever we are and pay $30 a ticket. We have the obligation to provide to you a great evening of entertainment. Certain truly gifted improvisationalists can do that night after night. But for most of us, it's very hit and miss, and I don't want to offer my audience a hit and miss opportunity. I want it to be a guarantee that it's the very best we know how to do. If it's not good enough, I understand, but it's our best shot.
It sounds like the rehearsal process for one of your actors or performers could be like a gift if you're allowing that kind of improvisation in the rehearsals to feed into what the final product is going to be. So you're encouraging creativity among anybody who works with you.
Everybody that works at Shadow, and it may be the main reason that they stay with me. I mean, we have got people that have been with me the entire 22 years.
If he's not doing that, you can call in right now. 292-8513 is the number to call. I know he is doing that because I've seen Steve Geyer's shows at Shadowbox, and they are – you'd never know that they weren't scripted. They're fresh every night. They're different every night, too, even the same show, which is terrific. Also, send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. If you prefer, we have to take a 90-second break now. I looked at the monitor. It's 90 seconds, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Stay tuned.
Oncologist Siddharth Mukherjee won a Pulitzer Prize this month for his book, The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about cancer's past and future and new drugs that can kill cancer cells while sparing normal ones. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss Governor Kasich's first 100 days in office. Jobs Ohio is facing a legal challenge, an update on Senate Bill 5, and more. Tune in for Columbus on the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. And some light rain in downtown Columbus. It's 45 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are possible throughout the day. Some of those storms could produce heavy rainfall, a high of 54 today. Showers and thunderstorms tonight, and the temperature will rise to 61 degrees overnight. And then rain likely for Saturday, mainly in the morning, clouds in the afternoon, a high of 68 degrees. That chance of rain sticks around for Saturday night, a low of 53, and still a chance of rain on Sunday, a high of 68. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides Weekend as we talk about the arts with three of the people who know more than anybody else about the arts in Central Ohio because they're actually out doing it and presenting it. Joy Riley is a professor of theater at The Ohio State University. She is WOSU's theater critic. You're also a writer yourself and a director, and you founded the Grandparents Living Theater.
That's right.
So, and an actress.
Yeah, and may I mention my own company
Howling at the Moon? Tell me about that.
Howling at the Moon has been around since 2002, and it's a group of performers, or actually women, the influence of the moon, and we write our own monologues and perform them for the audience, and we have jazz and Sherry.
And Sherry.
Yeah, we tour around. We've performed on different OSU campuses, and we've performed in different cities. It's part of the senior theater movement.
Terrific. Steve Geyer is the executive director and CEO of Shadowbox Live, and Chuck Helm is the director of performing arts at the Wexner Center. We had a call from Margie. She wasn't able to stay on the line, but she brought up the art sustainability study that was presented yesterday. Does anybody want to weigh in on that?
I had an opportunity to be at the Columbus Metropolitan Club as they were making this presentation. The actual study was presented some time ago, maybe as much as 45 days ago, but yesterday was a discussion panel at the Metropolitan Club where essentially they were talking about the difference between the city of Columbus, greater Columbus, and other cities of similar style and size, and the nature of what endowments were like in those other cities and support for the arts, et cetera, et cetera. The primary conclusions seem to be that Columbus has an extraordinary community of residents who are interested and excited about the arts in a broad and general sense. They don't seem to have any particular favorites. They just really love it in a general sense. On the other side of the coin, we have a very, very low level of sustainability, which is to say that we don't have the kinds of endowments that other cities our size have. Part of that, of course, is because we're not really an old city by comparison to many. Also, we have never been a city that has focused the might of our industrial wealth on the arts. It has been mostly focused on more industrial wealth, and that it may be time to begin refocusing some of that. But in order to make that happen, everybody has been very clear that we're going to have to reach out to our patron bases, understand how earned income plays a part, and do as much as we can, as Jack mentioned, or as Chuck mentioned earlier, to work on the collaborative side of what we're doing so that we're sharing resources in an effective way.
Chuck, how long have you been at the Wexner Center?
Almost 20 years.
So almost since it opened its doors.
Right. It opened in 89, fall of 89. I came in the summer of 91.
Tell me, over those 20 years, have you noticed, has it been what you expected? Have your expectations changed in terms of the audiences that you reach and how to reach them? Has the community changed? Talk about that sort of trajectory there.
Well, I think the community's changed incredibly, in the time that I've been there, and I certainly hear that from people that have grown up in Columbus and that have known the city longer than I have. I think, for us, the Wexner Center was a bit like the alien spaceship that landed in Central Ohio when we opened, and people were very skeptical about what the kind of work and the aesthetic that we represented.
Well, the building was a tourist attraction. The building itself was somewhat controversial.
Right, but I mean, I was a little surprised because I felt like there was a little bit of this attitude like, you're not going to pull the wool over our eyes with this stuff, right? But people, we've built an audience over years through partnerships, people feeling a little bit like they can depend on us. They know a little bit more what we do. They understand that we're not out here just trying to scare people and run people off, or we don't have a big attitude about this kind of thing. But I think it's grown immensely in that regard. Although the sustainability study, I think one of the things that's coming out of this, which I think is interesting for Columbus, is the whole notion about looking at the arts through the lens of quality of life issues. And I think that people are talking about, you know, revitalizing jobs and business climate. I think there's a realization now that these competitive cities, these cities that are doing better than Columbus perhaps in this regard, that also seem to also have, as a correlation, have very strong arts communities. It's because that feeds into their people's expectations today about the standard of living that they want. So, you know, they want great arts, strong arts organizations that are going to be vital, that are going to bring things that are going to be attractive to bringing people to move to Columbus that want to join businesses, just like they want nice parks and bike paths and these kinds of issues. And I think it's the knitting together, the sort of general kind of idea that you have to have all these elements to really be a thriving community. And it's great that the city, you know, powers that be are actually sponsoring these kinds of studies to really focus on these issues.
I think that started to happen in Columbus. This is just anecdotal. I can't prove it. That people were really wanting quality of life issues to really be at the forefront. About 5 or 6 years ago, I noticed a bit of a shift and a different change and maybe a better energy, just as the economy was tanking. Ironically enough is when that happened. But I think you're right. I think people are really looking to make this a destination city. And if they're going to move here, they want to stay, especially if they have young families. And that's another reason to do that.
Of course, I tell you, the one thing, I mean, there always is this emphasis of, like, let's get us a new slogan. You know, there's this whole issue about, well, now, Columbus doesn't have an identity. And that, to me, that's not the issue. The issue is strengthen these local assets, celebrate them for what they are, spread the word about them. And then the idea of a city's identity will emerge organically from that process. It's not just like looking at Austin, Texas and going, you know, they call themselves the live music capital of America. Let's call ourselves whatever, you know, of Ohio or the U.S. I mean, don't invent something like that. Just, or don't impose something. And it's not about hiring a big marketing firm for $1 million to kind of come up with a pithy, you know, three words to say that this is what you are.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. I think people should do their mission statements better than anybody else and just get on with it. And I think, as you say, I think that the demographic will shift and mellow out a little bit. Michael on Facebook has given us a very interesting comment. I want to get your reaction to this. He writes, I'm interested in what your guests consider to be the function of the performing arts in Central Ohio. As curators, producers, critics, what do you perceive to be the cultures and values produced by the performing arts that might be unique to this area? You started to address that, Chuck. Steve, you
honestly,
want to weigh in?
I think that when you're talking about what makes our approach to the arts unique, you're treading on a difficult ground, because to be honest, with every artist, there's a unique vision. Period. Everybody sees the world through their own eyes, and it is our responsibility to ourselves to express that. If we are successful in doing so, it'll resonate with someone else. I think that here in this region, we also feel that there's a kind of an essential breadbasket quality. We tend to take an awful lot of things in here. When you look at Central Ohio, this is an area where we are a very open community. We really welcome everybody, and it's not a hard place to live. Mm-hmm. And I think those kinds of qualities show up in our arts. The Wexner Center, I remember very well when things got started here. Chuck, you're right. People did look at it like an alien had landed. And, you know, what are you guys trying to do? Trying to cram some sort of bizarro New York art down, you know, Columbus's throat. But over time, everybody has begun to recognize, oh, you know what? We actually kind of like that stuff. It's pretty cool. And it really isn't that bizarre. It's just another way of looking at the world. And you look at a lot of what Joy has spent a large part of her career doing, whether it's teaching young people about art that didn't know anything about it the day before, or expressing the finest works of Shakespeare, whatever it might be. That is just as much a part of our daily lives as anything else, which is why we have a valid ballet in town and a symphony and pro musica and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things, in the most rounded possible sense, are what make us who and what we are. And I don't think we're necessarily saying anything unique as a community about the arts. What we're saying is unique things as individuals about the arts.
When you do collaborations, is there a danger that your vision, what you do, whoever you are, gets diluted? Is that something one has to guard against, or do you have to give a little bit to have a really good collaboration?
It's not a collaboration if you're not giving.
You have to give something.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's the nature of it. In fact, it's the joining of the ideas and finding a new paradigm that makes a collaboration work. If it's just you imposing yourself on somebody else, well, you've basically just hired their dancers or whatever.
Right.
To be collaborative, there has to be this joint.
Joy, what about you? What are your comments about perceiving the cultures and values of the arts in our area?
Well, it's interesting. I'm sort of interested in listening to what you have to say here because I'm not from the central Ohio. I mean, I grew up in England. I worked in London. I worked in Frankfurt, Germany. I mean, I moved in lots of major cities. When I came here, I just loved – I don't know why I love Columbus, but I absolutely did. And I really appreciate what it has here, and I find it absolutely amazing that the Wexner Center is here in the – And then when I go to Edinburgh or when I go to London, they say, this company is here. And I say, oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw them develop their work at the Wexner Center in our city in Columbus, Ohio. And people are just flabbergasted. And I say, yes, I remember Anne Bogart. She came in. She came and talked to us. The students talked to her. She told us why they were doing this. And
Ryzhnikov has been here.
People were invited into rehearsals. That is – that kind of thing here is absolutely priceless. And it involves and eventually arrives at something like the Roy Shakespeare Company being a collaborator with the Ohio State University and in this central area.
Yeah, they'll be here this summer, right?
Yes. So that, I mean, for me, the collaborations, the arts are collaborations. I feel that the arts are. Theater is a collaboration of a whole variety of arts. It's not just one thing.
I think one of the also important things that this sort of civic focus on the local art scene is happening is that it's helping inform a perspective on how many assets and resources in the arts this community actually has. And I think people were sort of taking things for granted in some ways.
I think that's very true.
I mean, I know in the sustainability study they're looking at these comparison cities, but I mean, Columbus has an incredible diversity of offerings from its arts organizations that are not rivaled in some of these comparable cities. If you look at Kansas City or Indianapolis or some of the other cities that they were looking at of similar kinds of locales and population sizes, Columbus actually has a far stronger across-the-board assets than those cities do. But as Steve was pointing out, they were saying, but, you know, we're not in a position where they're economically sustainable in this climate. So how do we make that adjustment to really make that happen?
Yeah, and we've got this amazing patron base in Columbus. The people who have chosen to live their lives here are really aggressively interested in what's going on in the arts. They are happy to express themselves. They are happy to come and see what we're doing. They're happy to be a part of it at any level if we ask them to. And that is not always there. I moved here about 30 years ago from the Carolinas and spent a lot of that time in Charlotte, for example. And, you know, it's a wonderful town. But the arts atmosphere at that time was radically different than it was here. The willingness to just open up and allow something like Shadowbox to succeed, or something like the Wexner Center to succeed, I don't know that it was there at that time. And certainly here in Columbus, those sorts of successes point to a willingness in terms of our patrons to come and support and see and participate in what we do that doesn't necessarily exist everywhere.
Well, you two gentlemen from the Wexner Center and Steve from Shadowbox, you are doing things that nobody else does. Really. I mean, certainly in this area. And the Wexner Center is very much a destination for people from coming all over the world. And as Joy said, if you go to Toronto or London and, oh, I saw Anne Bogart 3 weeks ago before you did, thank you very much. You know, that's a big deal about making it a destination. And I don't know a lot of, you know, when people think of Shadowbox, I thought of Second City, but that's different. They are different.
It's radically different. Yeah, there isn't anybody else doing quite what we do. There have been a few folks that have tried, and they've really just kind of given up because it's really hard.
It's hard, yeah.
I've been blessed with an incredible staff of very talented people that have helped make this dream a reality. And that's what's allowed us to do some of these other things. And I hope that we will continue to push that envelope and do the hard thing. I know that there's an expectation there that the Wexner Center is going to produce the most unusual work anyone's ever seen at the highest level possible. And I think Shadowbox has a very different and yet similar sort of expectation in that we'll produce pretty weird stuff, but it's always going to be a guaranteed interesting experience. You'll have a good time one way or the other.
What I would also say is even if I go to see things at either of your venues that I don't really understand, I always get my money's worth. Well, I mean, I always do. I never begrudge a dime when I walk out, even if I didn't quite get it. I always know I saw something. It's very important to me as a consumer, and I think to most of our listeners, to see things we haven't seen before, you know, or didn't know we liked, which I think is that's what I think Columbus is good at. I think that's what Columbus really is good at as a community for the arts. A practical comment now from Jim, and this is a good comment, and I like to address this as much as I can. How might someone stay aware of the types of events being talked about on this program so we don't miss anything? Can we direct people to one place where you can find out everything there is to do in Columbus? Do you know about
Joy? I don't know about one place. There is a Columbus, there's a roundtable website that people can access what's happening in theaters.
There's Experience Columbus has a website that is,
that's
is,
right.
is perhaps the best umbrella for civic atmosphere. But then again, I think that there's, when particular taste is involved, you really need to get involved with tracking, become a member or a subscriber to some of these organizations and then get really involved in them.
Also, I wanted to bring up an email we've had from James. A lot of our callers today haven't stayed on the line, but they've turned around and emailed us, so we are hearing from them anyway. James writes, one of the most interesting arts collaborations was when the late Andy Mann of CD 101 threw a rock benefit to save Ballet Met from bankruptcy. I wasn't really aware of that. Andy Mann's loss was terrible for the community and for all of us, but that's a great idea that it's such a mainstream station would turn around and say, you know, Ballet Met's well worth saving. Let's do it.
Well, you know, CD 101's whole history has been about being a locally owned, locally operated station and having a tremendous amount of civic pride. Their interest is not just in the success of that radio station. It's in the success of Columbus at large. And the potential loss of any great institution was very important. And Andy Mann's willingness to step up and take the lead in making something happen there wasn't unusual, and I don't think you'll find that to be unusual in many arts organizations. I think that willingness to understand that if we can each succeed on our own, then as a community we will succeed at a higher level is great.
Joy.
I wanted to ask Steve, I mean, this is a huge step you're taking moving downtown. I think it's very exciting because a lot happens downtown and a lot is happening and continuing to happen. What do you need to succeed down there? I mean, what do you need from the listeners? What do you need from what do you need to succeed down there?
I think more than anything else, Joy, we need an openness to the idea of what it is we're trying to do. And by that I mean, we want to establish a real community, which is to say artists who work in a community with one another and who represent the community that they live in and who are supported by the community that they live in. You know, one of the first things that we did when we moved down there was Julie Klein, who's our marketing director, became the president of the Brewery District Association. I mean, we're not even there yet. And yet our willingness to step up and take a leadership role in that community was all about what we felt was important in terms of the overall growth of that part of Columbus and what the arts could mean to that area. So from the listeners today and anybody that's already a patron and a participant with Shadowbox, what we're really looking for more than anything else is a willingness to go with us on the journey wherever we ask you to go. Sometimes that just means buying a ticket and coming to a show, but oftentimes it also means, look, here's this special event that we're doing because we need to support this other person. Come and be a part of that as well. That's not unlike what we're doing with Ballet Met.
I'll be crass. I'll just say it. Buy tickets already and become a member of the Wexner Center. That's how you support. That's what they need, too. The rest of it's gravy and great stuff, but that's what they need as well. I want to thank the three of you for coming out on a rainy day and spending an hour with us here at the studio and talking about the arts to the community. That's obviously very appreciative. Emma's only getting to be more so. My thanks to Joy Riley, WOSU's theater critic, professor at The Ohio State University, who, by the way, I was told that your portrayal of Eleanor of Aquitaine a number of years ago made everybody forget Katharine Hepburn. And people were afraid of you for months, so bravo for that. Steve Geyer with Shadowbox, best of luck to you for your new move. And you need hammers and people to help out, go to the website for Shadowbox and find out. And Chuck Helm at the Wexner Center, thank you very much for being here. Thank you all for listening. My thanks to our producer, Amy Jurovich. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD2. HD1 and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.